News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Also on the FM now at 5 o'clock on Saturdays on FM 105.9. You can catch us online as well at kmjnow.com. And you know the drill. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to first of all hear these stories that so many of them haven't told to too many people over all these years. We want to preserve those stories for posterity. We want to be inspired along the way. And most of all, thank our veterans, honor them for their service and their sacrifice. And we're going to do that today with 85-year-old Ralph Lynn of Sanger, California, or as he likes to call it, Clanger, because he's smack dab between Clovis and Sanger in a citrus grove out here in a beautiful part of our valley. And a little different than where you grew up, Ralph. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
That's correct. Yes, I was, Paul.
What do you remember about that day? Do you remember how you heard that news?
I guess on the radio that came over, and it was quite a shock, of course, but what is, or what was, I should say. And we were surprised, but at any rate, that's where I was.
And you were about 2 weeks shy of your 15th birthday. Did it occur to you that this might involve you at some point? You're wearing now your U.S. submarine World War II veteran hat, but I imagine at almost 15, you probably weren't thinking about getting in a boat that submerged.
That's correct, Paul. But everybody in my class, just about, at least all the male members of the class, became involved right away. They either joined up or were drafted, so it was a uniform thing that we went into the military.
And a couple years later, once you turned 17 in December of 43, you decided you were going to join the Navy?
That's correct. My dad was in World War One. He was in a battleship in World War One, and oh, it was kind of a tradition in the family, I suppose, that we follow that direction. He didn't pressure me on it, but I just thought it was a thing to do.
What were you expecting when you signed up for the Navy? Did you have an image in your mind of what that was going to be like, the places you would go and the kinds of things you would do?
Not really. At that time, we had a lot of things going through our mind, and I joined the Navy and went to boot camp at the Great Lakes.
What was that like? Boot camps on the shores of Lake Michigan there?
Cold. it was in the wintertime, and just unexpected that I'd find myself in the Navy, but there I was. And a lot of young guys about my age and thrown together, you just did it because it was the thing to do, or else get drafted. So I volunteered, and it was a worthy experience, I think.
Had you ever seen in person or even read much about a submarine? How familiar were you with that, even that concept of a submarine?
Not at all. I had no idea at all that I was going to end up there. They came around and told us about the submarine service, and sounded like a good idea because we heard the food was good and the pay was good, and it was something special. It was like joining the Air Force or joining the Marine Corps. It was a little different. So that's how I ended up in the submarine service.
So it was kind of the novelty, the uniqueness of it that seemed adventurous to you?
I think so. That's correct, yeah. And when I told my mother, she says, "You did what?" And at any rate, it was something special. And I went to submarine school at New London, Connecticut. There was a school there. They called it Spritz's Navy. There was a Charles Spritz was in charge, and he was a chief torpedo man. He was determined that he would break anybody that showed any weakness at all. I mean, he just stood in front of you and shouted at you, and it wasn't funny because he, you know, he said, what are you, a radio operator? I thought so, because only radio operators and yeomen, which was a secretary type of work, could be so stupid. I mean, and he had more at night people that he antagonized, slashed his tires. So, but it was called Spritz's Navy, and anybody that went through it, they learned to control themselves. So it was a rare experience.
Sounds like you had to grow up pretty fast out there.
Right away. Right away.
And you mentioned being a radio man. What did that entail? What kind of training did you get? And was that exciting for you? Was it tedious? How would you describe it?
Oh, it was different. It was repetitious that you learned the code, the Morse code. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da I could hear code and understand what they're saying. For example, the letter A is dit dot, and then B is da did it, and then C dot it, and D da did it. Well, you know, I haven't heard, I haven't listened to code since, well, I got out of the Navy. But I still remember that. Morse code isn't used anymore. But at that time, it was a communication system. They call it the code watch or radio watch. And you sit there with earphones on, and the code would come across. It'd say something like, to all ships at sea from Chief of Naval Operations. And then it'd go on. And all navies or all military operations were pretty well conducted with by code. I guess it was a pretty good duty. I sit there for half an hour or an hour on a watch. They called it a watch. And take code. And it was just part of the operation. I mean, you were either a radio operator or torpedo man or whatever the function that you happened to have a concern for or liking for. Radio operators were, it wasn't a big deal, but it was important, so that was how we looked at it.
When you would receive that Morse code, what would you do with it? Would you then translate it into plain English, pass it on to a superior officer, or what was your responsibility there?
Yeah, we had a communications officer, and would give it to him. He would translate it into plain English, of course, and give it to the captain.
Were there ever any memorable messages that stick out to you even today that you received via Morse code?
War is over.
Well, that's going to be a good one. Let's keep that one in our back pocket and come back to that if we stay chronological here. The you actually had the distinction of serving on two different submarines in World War II. Tell me about the first one and what your first impression of submerging and going on a patrol was.
The first one that I served on was called the Raton, R-A-T-O-N. And all submarines, they say all, most of the submarines were named for fish. And the Raton, I think, was a small tropical fish. There are some, there's the whale, the shark, and sea bass, and so on. And
I don't think they ever had one named the Delta Smelt, though, did they?
Delta Smelt? Not that I can recall.
Just a farmer joke there. But yeah, go ahead. The Raton, and submarines then were a lot different than they are now. I mean, for one, they had to surface every night to recharge the batteries. That sounds crazy to us, what we understand now. But
World War II, we were in what was called a diesel electric boat. And a boat, it's a submarine is really a ship because you can't just pick it up and put it on another boat or another ship, rather. But it was a diesel on the surface and ran by electricity, batteries, submerged. Toward the end of the war, it seems like there was a fellow named Admiral Hyman Rickover who introduced the nuclear-propelled submarine. And but everything that during World War II was pretty much diesel electric. The Germans were technology wise, they were, I guess they had pretty much comparable propulsion. Ours were much more comfortable than theirs, I think, but they were good sailors. Good submarine people, I would say.
What were your duties on the Raton and the time that you spent on that sub? What do you remember of that?
I started out, most young guys, which I was at the time, were started out doing menial tasks like captain of the head.
Captain of the head, that sounds like a very prestigious position, doesn't it?
It sounds like it, but really it, what it involves is you're in charge of keeping the men's room cleaned. And if you're just starting out, it's often mess cook and that kind of thing, but you do have special assignments. Mine was they call the radioman striker, which means you're working to become a radio operator, and so I did that, and also operated radar and sonar, but primarily I was a radioman.
You know, radar and sonar seem so commonplace to us now, but in the 1940s, and especially you're still a teenager, I imagine that probably had to feel like you were living in a comic book or something, huh?
Yeah, it was... But, you know, you just, it was something you did. I mean, theirs was not the reason why. Submarine was a complex machine, complex equipment, and you had to learn it. Every submariner was expected to learn various tasks. In other words, you had to learn what the duties were by your shipmates, and they called it qualifying. And you had to know what valve to turn, and it was a matter of pride, too, that you learned what the other guy did, because your life and the life of your shipmates depended on being at the right place and knowing what to do.
And it seems like that was even more so on a submarine than any other ship, because when you're on a surface ship, if you get bombed, you get blown up, whatever, you can abandon ship, you might make it. If you're on a submarine and you get torpedoed and you're not coming up, you're never coming up, right?
That's correct. The Squalus was a ship that sank. Somebody left a valve open, and the ship was flooded, and close to half of the men died on that, on the Squalus. It's possible to get out of a submarine that sinks, but in the case of the Squalus, they lost a lot of men.
26 men, according to what I've read, but there's also a remarkable rescue story associated with the Squalus, which would return to naval operations later with another name and a submariner by the name of Ralph Lynn aboard a few years later. We'll discuss that and more, like the colorful sailor who ordered Ralph around in New London, Connecticut, before becoming a baseball legend with the New York Yankees. Which one might that be? Hometown Heroes will continue after a word from some of our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC. friends, no tea.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Believe it or not, this is the 200th episode of this program here on KMJ. What a privilege it is each and every week to visit with veterans here in Central California and beyond. I call the program Hometown Heroes because I am convinced no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or small your hometown might be, there are heroes in your hometown, people right under your nose that did things you might not even imagine for the sake of freedom, like serving on a submarine that had already been sunk once. That's the case of our guest today, 85-year-old Ralph Lynn of Sanger, California. Maybe you saw him at Sanger Rotary this week. Maybe you know Ralph and his wife Elaine from church. Maybe you remember the years that Ralph spent on the Clovis Unified School Board when that district was taken off in the 60s and 70s. But even if you do know Ralph, I'm guessing you haven't heard all his submarine stories from World War II. And we'll get back into that now. When we left off, Ralph was talking about a submarine called the Squalus that sank in a test dive near Portsmouth, New Hampshire in May of 1939. 26 men died in that accident. The remaining 33 were rescued. Four enlisted men even earned the Congressional Medal of Honor for diving down to facilitate that rescue. After more than 600 dives for rescue and salvage purposes, the Squalus was finally raised and repaired. It would eventually be given a new name before Ralph Lynn ever came aboard. And there's a good story about how that new name came about, isn't there, Ralph?
That's correct, Paul. And when they brought it up, why, Franklin Roosevelt was there to watch this salvage operation, and they brought it up by pumping the water out of it, and it shot up through the surface, and Roosevelt said, "That looks like a sailfish, the way that came up and then went back down," but so it was called the sailfish. When a submarine sunk, if it's rechristened, why, they'll usually give it a different name. The Squalus was called the sailfish, and a lot of the sailors on board start calling it the squalefish, and the captain took exception to that, and he said, "If I hear anybody calling this the squalefish, I'm going to court-martial them and leave them on a desert island." And he was very serious about that. So at any rate, that was never again called the Squalefish.
So when you joined that crew, I'm sure you were indoctrinated pretty quickly in what not to call it, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. You walk the line.
What was it like on the Sailfish? And do you remember the first patrol that you went on, or the first moment where it became real to you that there was an enemy out there and you're in a war?
Yes, I do. And it was spooky a little bit. But you're trained for that, and nobody feels like they're going to be killed, I suppose. That's an overstatement, but when you're young like that, you just do what you have to do and pray for the best. You know, there was a saying, it was a newspaper man that said, there are no atheists in the foxholes of Bataan. And I guess there were no atheists that I ever met in the submarine service. They all, you know, you talk to God and you do your share of praying when there's depth charges are going off around you. Thank the Lord we got back. So
can you tell us specifically about one of those instances and one of those moments where you felt the need to pray and felt like things could go awry at any moment?
Yeah, I heard some destroyers had us cornered, and they dropped these depth charges. Fortunately, we got away. And there's always a certain fear factor when you're in a position like that. And I was in the latter part of the war, so I didn't encounter quite the problems that a lot of guys did. But
you talk about depth charges going off around you. Paint a picture, if you can, of what it's like to be on that submarine. Would you say it was chaotic? Were guys calmly going about their business? What did you have to do?
We all had our assignments and dozens of duties, you know, when you're submerged. There was no radio operation going on, so we just stood by whatever the assignments were.
Were you ever in situations where you could feel the impact of some of that enemy firepower, that the ship was shaking, you were, you know, rocking a little bit? What did it feel like?
As I recall, there was a click, click, and then the boom, and it just shook the boat if it was nearby. That's somewhat frightening.
It sounds like you felt that more than once.
Yeah, although I was not, I don't know that I ever thought I was not coming back, but yeah, it's, as I said, you start praying, thank God, it's you forget about it, and I don't mean you forget about it, but...
You don't dwell on it, huh?
Exactly, Paul. That's right.
I have a link on our website, kmjnow.com, where you can read more about the exploits of the USS Sailfish in World War II. The incident that Ralph just described occurred near the Philippines in November of 1944, and the Sailfish, after that long, drawn-out incident, was able to escape, of course. There were other times where the sub was able to pick up airmen who had bailed out of crippled bombers. That was a common use of submarines in the Pacific. The record of U.S. submarine forces in World War II is very, very impressive if you've ever investigated it. Submarines made nearly 1,600 patrols during the war, primarily in the Pacific, but also a few in the Atlantic, as well as European and North African waters. They were able to sink. This blows me away. They were able to sink nearly 1,400 Japanese ships, or about 34 Japanese ships for every one U.S. submarine lost in action. Counting combat operations and accidental sinkings, there were 52 U.S. submarines lost during the war. That is no doubt a heavy, heavy cost. It represents about 18% of the submarine force. But the destruction inflicted on the enemy was really remarkable. For such a small portion of the Navy to account for such a lion's share of the damage, and that's something that every submariner I've encountered has taken great pride in, Ralph, and it seems like you do too.
I think 55% of the enemy ships sunk were sunk by submarines. More than half of all enemy shipping was sunk by submarines.
Yeah, and this includes ships that are carrying supplies and things like that also. Were you ever on one of those subs when your sub sunk an enemy ship? And if so, what was the reaction like aboard the sub?
Elation. Yeah, you're happy. And it's a pride, I suppose.
I think our audience would be curious about this, to be in your shoes on a submarine. If you were able to sink an enemy ship of any kind, would there be an announcement aboard your sub? How would you find out that that had happened?
Yeah, there's a intercommunication system, and the skipper or the officer would say, well done.
Well, sometimes that's all you need to hear. I could understand the elation, probably some relief too. And you know, another thing that I'm often entertained by on this program are the stories of how guys pass the time when they weren't in combat. In your case, when you weren't on one of these nerve-wracking submarine patrols. And I understand you spent a good amount of your time in sports-related activities. I know in the years since, you've gotten to watch your kids and grandkids participate in sports. Your grandson, Aaron Lynn, was an accomplished pitcher at Clovis West and then Fresno Pacific. I certainly remember that. But all those years ago, back in World War II, what kind of sports were you involved in?
Basketball. And played on a football team. And
where was that, the football team?
Well, it was at the submarine base. I met a fellow by the name of Harry Stuhldreher. He was a quarterback on the Four Horsemen, and he was coaching at Wisconsin, where I went to radio school. And that was a big thrill for me, because the Four Horsemen, I don't know if you ever heard of them, Paul, but there was a Miller, Crowley, Layden, and Stuhldreher. Harry Stuhldreher, as I said, was a quarterback, and he was coaching the football team at the university, and went to see him, and I said, can I come out for your football team, coach? And he said, how long are you going to be here? And I said, well, I'm shipping out in 3 weeks, and he said, well, come see me after you come back from the war. I didn't. But it was a thrill to meet him, because they had the Notre Dame box, which was something like the T formation. Or if you were going to go into coaching, if you had his stamp on you, why, that would have been a good recommendation, I guess.
No doubt, I'm sure it would. A disciple of Newt Rockne himself there. The Four Horsemen of Notre Dame, of course, dominated college football in the early 1920s with Harry Stuhldreher leading those Four Horsemen. But that's not the only famous sports figure that you encountered in your Navy days. When we come back for the final stretch of Hometown Heroes, I'm going to have Ralph tell us about a name just about all of us know, both as a baseball legend and, I guess you could say, an oft-quoted philosopher. Maybe I should say this show ain't over till it's over. Just a little hint for you there. We'll have Ralph clue us in after I tell you a little bit more about one of our proud sponsors of Hometown Heroes on KMJ, Steve Cloud and the fine folks at Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it, they have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A pleasure visiting with 85-year-old Ralph Lynn of Sanger, California today. He is a Navy veteran who served on two different submarines during World War II. We've gotten a taste of what that undersea service was like, and when we left off before the commercial break, Ralph was talking about that thrill early in his training of meeting Harry Stuhldreher, who had become famous in the early 1920s as one of Notre Dame's four horsemen on the gridiron. That's someone whose acclaim preceded your meeting him, but in another case, Ralph, it was the other way around. You spent some time with a guy who would become a household name, a baseball legend, and a name so famous it was even borrowed or mimicked, if you will, by a popular cartoon character. Tell me about this terrific ball player who's as famous now for his head-scratching quotations as he is for his winning ways.
Yeah, his name was Lawrence Berra, and we called him Yogi. And he was from the Italian section of St. Louis called The Hill. And Yogi was he was my boss, and he was called a Specialist A. This A was for athletics, and sort of carefree, I guess. He was well-liked. He played on the baseball team.
And where was this?
That was in Connecticut at New London.
Right, in New London, Connecticut, where the sailfish brought you back after that final patrol in the Pacific through the Panama Canal, of course. It says here the sailfish got back there to New London in late January of 1945, and by this time Yogi Berra was already back from some intense experiences in the European theater. In fact, before we get more of Ralph's recollections of Yogi, you're going to enjoy that. I thought maybe we should hear a bit about what the Hall of Famer himself did. You know, I often wonder if, God forbid, we were in a worldwide war today, would our top athletes be heading overseas to fly airplanes, to serve in the Army or Navy, like so many of the best and brightest did in World War II? On this program, we've heard about some of the Hollywood stars, the top-notch sports stars, doing their part during the war. And Yogi Berra was yet to make it to the big league, so it wasn't, I guess, like Ted Williams interrupting his Red Sox exploits. But Yogi actually saw some pretty hairy action during the invasion of Normandy, and I thought maybe we'd take a detour and listen to a little interview Yogi Berra did with the Academy of Achievement about his Navy days in World War II. So here he is, the one and only Yogi Berra.
I got in the Navy when I was 18 years old, and from there, sent me to Bainbridge, Maryland for boot camp. Then they shipped me down back to Norfolk, where I started from, Little Creek down there, base down there. And I got tired of sitting around. Then they said, we're looking for volunteers to go into amphibs. And they didn't tell us what kind of boat, though, just in the amphibs. So I joined it. I said, well, I'm going to join the amphibs. They'll be 18 years old. And then they said I was on a rocket boat. 36-footer with 12 rockets on each side, five machine guns, a twin 50 and a 330s. They're only 36 feet, and they were made out of wood and a little metal. And when we went back to Bainbridge to do some woody training. And I couldn't write home and tell them what I was doing because them boats weren't out yet for the invasion of Normandy. So we start training there, and then we come back to Little Creek again. We started to train a little bit what we were supposed to do, and it's amazing what that little boat could do, though, that 36-footer. We could shoot out of rockets. We could shoot one at a time. We could shoot two at a time, or we could shoot all 24 at a time. We went in on the invasion. We were the first ones in before the army come in. D-Day, yeah, in Normandy. And we stand out about 300 yards off the beach. And we see what happens if we ran into anything. We fire. First of all, we fire one rocket to find out if it reached the beach. And if it did, then we let out, shoot them all. We had rockets on, extra rockets to fire. And we had smoke pots on and everything. We did pretty good. We stayed on the water for 10 days. They gave us sea rations, the eat while we were on it, slept on it. We finally got back on the ship, the U.S. Bayfield, P-833. We were so tired, they said. And no sooner I got in the bed, we get a general quarters alarm. I said, tough luck, I'm not getting out of this bed. I'm staying right in it. Fortunate enough, nothing happened to us. We're lucky. But you just get so tired, you got to say, but then I enjoyed it. I wasn't scared opening when going into it. It looked like 4th of July. It really did. 18-year-old kid going in an invasion. But I've never seen so many planes in my life we had going over there.
So that is the voice of Yogi Berra, who, if he hadn't survived that rocket boat assignment on June 6, 1944 at Normandy, would never have played a single game for the Yankees, let alone become a 15-time All-Star, a 3-time American League MVP, catch Don Larsen's perfect game in the 1956 World Series, or participate in a total of 21 different World Series as a player or manager. We'll get to Ralph Lynn's recollections of Yogi in just a second, but first, one more clip of Yogi Berra. When he came back from serving overseas and participating in the invasion of Normandy, he returned to Norfolk, Virginia, and they told him he was going to the submarine base in Connecticut. He hadn't volunteered for submarines, and he didn't want to go, but they reassured him.
No, we're going to send you up to a ship's company. You get on a base up there. I said, okay. So I went in, they had a ball team. We were making a ball team there. And Jim Gleason, that played with Cincinnati Reds, was our lieutenant commander there. He was in charge of the athletic director in there. And he asked me, what do you do? I said, I play ball. He thought I was a boxer at first, you know. And I said, no, I play ball. And he said, who you play with? I said, I belong to the Yankees. He didn't believe me. Then we built our own ballpark at New London Submarine Ball Base. We played there. And he would never use me for a while. Then he finally put me in for a pinch hitter. I got a home run, and he said, then I stayed in. he made me play. He was a good man, the Lieutenant Commander. Jim Gleason, he was a good man. I made him a coach after I was manager. He was a great guy.
So that is how Yogi Berra came to play for the submarine-based team in New London, Connecticut, where our guest today, Ralph Lynn, first encountered him. Sorry for that little detour, but I don't know how many of you knew that about the guy who, among other great quotes, is responsible for this one of my favorites. He said, I really didn't say everything I said. That's a classic. One of a kind, Yogi Berra. And Ralph, you got to see him play before the rest of the world did.
We loved to watch him play ball. He played in the outfield at the time, and occasionally a fly ball would bounce off of his head. But he could hit the heck out of the ball, and he was a lot of fun. And
maybe some of those fly balls bouncing off the head explain some of the wacky things that he became famous for saying in his Hall of Fame baseball career. Did you have any idea, when you watched him play baseball, did you have any idea that he could be as good as he became?
I think everybody thought that Yogi was going to be a big leaguer, and he was pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, it was quick, because it was only about a year and a half later that he made his big league debut for the Yankees in September of 1946.
But he was fun to be around, and he was a great hitter, obviously. And
you said he was your boss. What kinds of things did he put you to work on?
Cleaning the head. I would mop the basketball floor. As I mentioned, sports were a big deal for the guys at that age. And so when I was captain of the head. It was a euphemism or whatever for cleaning the toilets. And it was okay. You just did that kind of stuff.
And you said you guys called him Yogi. Did he come with that nickname? Was it already attached to him before you guys met him?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you remember when you first picked up a newspaper or heard a radio broadcast and you heard about Yogi Berra winning the World Series with the Yankees? What kind of moment was that like for you?
Happy. Everybody loved Yogi. He was fun to be around. And I don't know if he had, I think his wife was Carmi. I don't know if he had met her then or not. But he was just... he was just nice to be around.
Did he ever used to say things that made you shake your head a little bit, the way he later became famous for?
Yeah, I can't. I have a book of Yogi-isms, and wasn't surprised that he worked out like he did. But papers made him out to be, kind of goofy, but there was a certain common sense that Yogi exhibited. He was just, he was a good guy. There was a couple fellas there that went on to success, real success in sports. There was a fellow named Dub Jones, and Dub Jones was a All-American football player, I think, Tulane, and he was outstanding. He went on and played at I think Chicago Bears or one of those Midwestern teams, and he was a great receiver.
Well, you're right. He was drafted by the Chicago Cardinals in 1946. He ended up achieving his biggest stardom with the Cleveland Browns, where he was a part of all those great NFL championship teams of the early 1950s with Otto Graham at quarterback. Dub Jones was one of his biggest weapons. In 1951, he combined for over 1,000 yards between rushing and receiving. And football fans of a more recent vintage might remember his son, Burt Jones, a very successful quarterback in the NFL as well.
I can remember throwing the ball with Dub, and I said, what's Dub stand for? He says, W.A. Jones, William Augustus Jones. So they shortened that to Dub, but he was a great athlete.
Well, and I bet people listening to this want to know about your own athletic exploits. If you're competing with all these guys who went on to make names for themselves, what'd you do yourself athletically after you were done in the Navy?
Well, I wasn't in their class. I would like to have been, but I did play some. I played at Westchester was the school that I went to. And we played schools like Appalachia and the University of Delaware and Villanova in that bracket. And we had a very good small college team, lettered for 4 years, and it was enjoyable. I was not especially large. I was about 5'10", and weighed maybe 175, and played end.
One more on Yogi. In all the years since you knew him in the Navy, I mean, we're talking almost 70 years. Did you ever have a chance to meet up with him again or watch him play a ball game or anything like that?
I went down to Yankee Stadium one time and after the war, and I had a chance to say hello. And it was nice to see him. He's just a good person.
Well, I'm sure everyone is happy to hear about those stories. And you said something earlier when I asked you about memorable things that you heard on Morse code. And you said, the war is over. Tell me about that moment.
Well, I think we were expecting it. And when there's a realization that, hey, maybe I'm not going to get killed in this war. And good feeling.
A lot of guys heard an English announcement, the war is over. But for you to get it in Morse code, I mean, that's a pretty unique situation. I doubt too many people heard about it that way.
I suppose, yeah. I never thought much about it. But, what's done is done. And when the atomic bomb went off, why, we realized that, well, that's it. You hate to think of all the lives that were lost, but I think everybody, well, it had to be, so.
And 400,000 American lives were lost in that war as well. I'm sure there were times you wondered if you would be one of them. When you think about it now, never having the chance to meet your wife of 60 years, never having any children or grandchildren, or having this acreage out in Clanger, as you call it, looking at all these oranges and lemons, how do you chalk that all up? How do you account for the fact that you're here and so many other guys aren't?
You feel sad about the lives that were lost, and you know that war is a terrible thing, but I think that our country has got a lot to be proud of, what we've done. And I lost some friends in the war. I don't know how many. I was in a small high school, but out of a graduating class of 50, probably 10, 15, 20 of them were killed. So that's war.
That hat you're wearing, it says U.S. Submarine Force World War II veteran. Doesn't look like it's the first time you've worn that, so I know you wear that with pride.
I have a lot of guys, a lot of people are curious about submarines, and they'll come up and ask me about it. Were you really in the submarine? And they ask about it, and occasionally, and this is what I get a kick out of, is somebody says, "What boat were you on, mate?" And I say, well, I was on the Raton or the Sailfish. And they say, oh, did you know so-and-so? And that's a real thrill. It doesn't happen often because so many of the submariners have passed on.
Indeed. That's why we do this, to preserve the stories of our greatest generation, a group I know you're proud to be a part of.
I think the greatest generation involved a little bit of not just being in the war, but also living through the Depression. That was a very difficult time for most people in the country because there's a lot of hunger and so on. I suppose there's a feeling of pride of being part of that generation. And, Hitler was a force of evil, and millions of people died because of him, and just doing away with that mentality was a feat.
No doubt. Well, Ralph, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it.
I enjoyed visiting with you, and you know, hopefully there will be an end to the wars. But at any rate, I'm proud of where we are and what we've done, and I love this area, and I've been blessed with a nice family.
Amen. Well, we're out of time this week. Join us again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.